There is a photograph of my dad as a toddler, a black and white studio portrait from the 1940s, a matte finish to the surface and a narrow white border around its well-thumbed edges. My dad is grinning a wet, lopsided grin. You can almost hear him squeaking and gurgling, his eyes on what I imagine is some kind of toy being waved in the extended arm of the photographer behind his tripod. Bathed in the glow of professional lighting, my dad's little hands are clapped together like two starfish, chubby fingers splaying from the palms. The photographer must have been very pleased with himself to have captured such a moment of sheer rapture. There's no mistaking who this is. 70-odd years later, and he's still somehow grinning that irrepressible, froggy grin, usually when he's succeeded in winding someone up. But what dominates in the image is the thing wrapped around his head, catching up the wisps of his hair. Tied around his head is a cartoonishly huge, bright satin bow. My grandmother Sonia was 36 when she gave birth to my dad in 1943 in occupied Poland. Considering her age, old by the standards of the day, and the fact that they were living through a war, she regarded my dad's birth as a miracle, later telling him he'd arrived via the skies in one of the United Nations relief parcels that were dropped from aeroplanes, tucked in amongst the dried milk, tinned pork and Ovaltine. In those days, you had to take what you could get. Only Sonia hated Ovaltine, and to be honest, as grateful as she was for her miracle, she would have really preferred a girl. So until he reached the age of 5 or thereabouts, my dad had been raised by his mother as though he were a girl. When I ask him what he remembers of those early years, he recalls the shopping trips when he would scurry off and hide while his mother haggled over market stalls. He'd always regret it once she began to holler, "Slavinka!" A feminized version of his name, each syllable ringing like bells until he came out of hiding, pigtails bouncing either side of his flushed face. He's not embarrassed about it now, and certainly holds no grudge against Sonia. If anything, he's just faintly amused. "She simply wanted another girl," he says. "It wasn't a big deal. And besides, lots of other little boys were sent to school with kokarda in their hair." When I ask him why, he shrugs and says, "Polish mothers." I wonder if this early experience has something to do with the fact that my dad has never made me conscious of needing to perform my gender or behave in a certain way accordingly. He spoiled me with presents as a child, usually clothes or books, but the gifts reflected his total disregard for conformity. A taffeta princess dress one week was casually followed by a pair of boxing gloves and silky Lonsdale training shorts the next. One hot summer evening, he came home with an expensive pair of bright red, bulbous snow boots, over which my mum threw a fit. My parents weren't rich, and he couldn't keep spending like this, buying snow boots in August. I was a tomboy and very shy. I actually enjoyed trying on the taffeta dress at home, but I would have been embarrassed to wear it out. I remember smoothing the turquoise moiré against my legs, feeling its cool recalcitrance and gazing at its holographic ripples, strangely reminiscent of the grain of wood. My parents had only known each other for 6 months before my mum became pregnant with me and moved into my dad's rented top-floor flat in a vertiginous Victorian house in Kilburn, northwest London. The kitchen was largely given over to a broken motorcycle that my dad was convinced he could fix. A skeletal baby's buggy, another repair project reluctantly relinquished, had been chucked out of the window in a fit of my mum's decluttering, getting trapped in the branches of a huge pear tree in the garden. The main staircase was coming away from the outer wall of the house as it succumbed to subsidence, the threat of which was especially felt when sitting on the toilet, with a large crack between the floor and the wall bringing the downstairs neighbours into uncomfortable proximity. The ceiling in the bedroom would collapse on the night I was brought home from the hospital and be held up with an improvised acroprop in the form of an artist's easel. My dad, an artist and immigrant who had always worked a variety of odd or low-paid jobs, had recently begun taking on private commissions to restore paintings and objets d'art for the rich people of neighbouring Hampstead and Highgate, placing adverts in the local Ham and High Express. In the run-up to my birth, my maternal grandma, who had many anxieties about my dad, not least his precarious income and the even more precarious domestic situation into which he'd somehow lured her daughter, had spotted another newspaper ad. The National Gallery in London was looking for a frame conservationist. In the week that I was born, he successfully secured the National Gallery job on the strength of his mostly self-taught restoration skills, which were in no small part influenced by the very thorough and technical education he'd received as an art student in Warsaw. Once he'd started work, a rumour also came to his attention, a rumour that I imagine might have been imparted with a certain relish for its salaciousness and because it would bring the pole down a peg or two. My dad had been second choice. The first candidate to be offered the position had had it subsequently retracted after his criminal record had come to light. His crime had apparently taken place in America and been something to do with gross indecency, a statute almost exclusively reserved for the prosecution of sexual acts between men. 12 and a half years I survived in the heart of the British establishment is one of my dad's favourite refrains. My mum scoffs at the recurring boast of 12 and a half years. And eventually they kicked you out because you were always pushing it, acting the big shot with that inflated Polish ego of yours, always inviting friends for coffee and getting them to call you from reception. No wonder you got on their nerves. Well, at least they had to pay my redundancy. But you are always banging on about your piddly 12 and a half years. That's nothing. I worked for 40 years in the same fucking job. If it wasn't for my pension, where would you be? I join in the chorus, the word Dad uses when accusing me and my mum of ganging up on him, and add that in some instances, he's not always the victim. You do have certain privileges, you know. You got that job ostensibly because the other guy was gay. I mean, how does that even make you feel? He shrugs, contorting his face into an expression of rueful surrender. Listen, Phoebs. We all end up on the shit heap eventually. During his lunch breaks at work, Dad would troll the bookshops of Charing Cross Road for volumes of Hans Christian Andersen and Dickens, folk tales from around the world, White Fang, the first book he'd ever read in English. Urging them on me, he'd tell me of how he read them all, passionately. Around the age of 14, he gave me a book by Andrea Dworkin, and several monographs on the artist Louise Bourgeois. When I ask him now why he'd chosen those books, he says that he'd always wanted me to become a feminist. I'm pretty sure he hadn't read any Dworkin, but had come across some article about her and was simply attracted to anything radical and controversial. But why all the monographs on Louise Bourgeois in particular? He reiterates his desire for me to become a feminist and adds, "She was fantastic. She had a Canadian lover, and they used to go to Polish cafes." I have no hesitation in believing that the real crux of his admiration for Louise Bourgeois rested on her patronage of Polish cafes. When I came out, my dad seemed pretty unfazed. I would soon find out that it wasn't as simple as it appeared, but as with all things to do with my Polish family and their motivations, there's no straightforward path to the truth of things. "Phoebs," he says, "this thing about lesbians and gays and transgender, there's nothing new about it." "Well, of course there isn't," I say. "But what do you mean? What are you trying to say?" "I'm not trying to say anything. But people think it's something new. Why are they always banging on about it all the time? Wait, who do you mean? Do you mean gay people are always banging on? Firstly, that's a shit way to put it. And secondly, in Poland, he says. Yeah, in Poland, gays have to defend themselves. You think you do that by keeping stum, as you always say. Keep stum is one of my dad's enduring catchphrases, often deployed at the end of a phone call. He shakes his head as though I'm not quite getting his drift and continues. When I was a kid, I used to go passionately to the street shop on Francuska, you know, where Haneczka lives, Francuska Street, to Wedel's sweet shop. As soon as I had some pocket money, I would get a bag of raisins and chocolate. They were my absolute favourite. Why are you suddenly bringing this up? I ask. Because there was this woman. She was always in there whenever I went, always wearing the most incredible outfit. These tall brown leather boots and, what are they called, the trousers I like, you know, like the ones I used to buy on eBay. You mean jodhpurs? Yes, jodhpurs. She always wore jodhpurs and these brown boots and a jacket with a belt fastened at the waist. Some kind of riding outfit. Yes, but her hair was cut short, you know, completely shaved up the sides, just like a man's. She looked completely masculine, but I think she wore makeup. She had a powerful face, red lips. Maybe she was an actress. I don't think she was going riding. I admit that she sounds amazing. She was. But what's your point? Well, she must have been a lesbian. As fascinated as I am with this image of this woman from my dad's memory, I hesitate to agree that she was, categorically, a lesbian. But me and my friends, we were kind of scared of her because she was a woman, but she looked like a man. So we called her Baba Dziad, he says. Baba Dziad, I remember her just like yesterday. What does Baba Dziad mean? Baba Dziad? Baba means woman and Dziad is a man. She was a woman man, you know, Baba Dziad. Later, I checked the translation myself. Baba is rather a sort of hag or crone, and Dziad is a derogatory term for an old man or beggar. A Polish friend confirms that there's nothing neutral about the nickname Baba Dziad. So why was she always in the sweet shop? What do you mean? She was buying sweets. She would always buy the raisins and chocolate too. They were really the best. I was only a boy, but my point is, we all knew about Baba Dziad. And she didn't give a fuck. She dressed like that, and she didn't give a fuck. And nobody gives a fuck if you're a lesbian or not. The way he stresses lesbian betrays a vague aspect of giving a fuck about something. But unfortunately, I say, people do, you know, and in Poland, he waves his hand as though I'm still not really getting his point. Listen, Phoebe, Poland is a schizo country. It always has been and always will be. And why did you call her Baba Dziad? It sounds kind of, because we were kids and she looked a bit scary. But so what? She didn't give a fuck. I consider arguing that perhaps he hadn't gleaned the entire complexity of her story since he was a child and had only observed this person on the occasions that they both happened to be in Wedel's buying raisins and chocolate. I consider how my dad often bases his whole judgment of character on a detail as seemingly minor as the fact that someone also enjoys raisins and chocolate. I could argue that it's not fair that a lesbian, if indeed she had been a lesbian, that her place in the world had to be carved out by creating a distinct attitude of not giving a fuck. But he's gone, lost in the memory, fondly cooing. Baba Dziad, I remember her just like yesterday. Those tall brown boots. She was fantastic.
The tongue sits in the middle of the room. It is bigger than I, it is taller than I, it is better than I. When and if I want to say something, the tongue begins to move. Its center bends and twists, its tip rocks back and forth in rhythm. The tongue speaks. Someone took away the rose-tinted, semi-transparent masking shielding visor off my face. Every time the deep, illuminating, electrifying brown eyes closed and opened, the room smelled coconut oil melting. Every time the hot chocolate brown eyelashes fluttered, time warped. Things moved in a slow-mo. Sound was faintly muted and colors were softly desaturated. A handsome ginger cat wrapped its tail around my shin, serenading its love and expecting mine in return. Are we good? Do you like that? How about this? The cat brushes its soft, hairy cheek against my bare knee. Weeping willows hunched over, tickling my nose. Hummingbirds whirred around my mouth. Their tiny beaks opened ajar, spitting out honey on the tip of my tongue. The kindness. The giraffe appeared from the trees, its walk bouncy, its presence sunny, its posture grand. I straightened my back, that's it, baby, feel the strength of your spine and lift the crown of your head. That's it, baby, hold it tight, bring those delicious ribs together, knees open and knees closed. Let the heels of your feet meet, let the muscles of your thighs make a pearl, you are a pearl. Snap. The soundless white slippers and the ironed, brilliant white gowns come in and out of the room. The white fluorescent light squints. It washes colors away. It flattens everything in the room and makes everything equally unflattering. The smell of hygiene products goes hand in hand with the efficiency of the white cube. The tongue stops, a moment of silence. It begins again, slower this time. Fine weather, isn't it?